We've got a cool idea for something to do beginning tomorrow at the Air Zoo Museum in Portage, Michigan. Have you been to the Air Zoo? It sounds like a very cool place. I've not been there, but I've seen billboards for it, and I've seen things online about it. They're celebrating the arrival of a World War II bomber that served in the Pacific. And after the war, late 40s it appears, it crashed into Lake Michigan near Waukegan, Illinois, where it sat submerged, waterlogged, and very lonely, I'm sure. It was considered lost forever until 2009. Nothing is lost forever anymore. Have you noticed that? It's one of the most exciting things about living in the 21st century. Nothing is lost forever anymore. We can figure things out about the past that we couldn't even dream of 50 years ago. But this Dauntless dive bomber, the Dauntless, arrives at the Air Zoo in Portage tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock and will be there thereafter, I take it. More information at airzoo.org, airzoo.org in Portage, Michigan. I'm Mark Bayshore. This is Current State here on WKAR. We're glad you're along today. More charges stemming from the Flint water crisis were filed this month by Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette. That and a costly plan to fund a relaunched Detroit Public School District topped Michigan news in June. Here to discuss those and other developments on Current State's Month in Review segment, John Lindstrom, publisher of Gongwer News Service, Michigan. Welcome back, John.
Hi, how are you?
I am well. And Kyle Malin joins us also. Kyle's editor and vice president of the Lansing-based MERS newsletter. Good to see you, Kyle.
Hey, good morning, Mark.
Let's kind of work our way back through the month, which is typically how we do it here. Attorney General Bill Schuette announced Tuesday that Governor Snyder's private attorneys have not been providing documents that his office is seeking regarding the Flint water crisis. John, what more can you tell us about this?
Well, at this moment, not a lot more than that. Now, last week when the Attorney General announced civil suits against two companies, Viola and Lan, there were suggestions made that certain documents were not being released, but by whom it wasn't said. At a press conference that the Attorney General had this week, he made it quite specific that the private attorneys that Governor Snyder has hired basically to watch over any possible criminal situations that the Attorney General might find that could involve the governor had not released documents that they had asked for. Now, the governor's office says that's crazy, that they've given hundreds of thousands of pages of documents to the Attorney General. They've gotten no complaints from the Attorney General on what they have sent. But Schuette said there is still stuff that has not been released. He wouldn't say what. He didn't say what specifically they're looking for. But he repeated several times, we will get them. We will find a way to get them. And when it was asked, does that include going to court, he would simply say, we will get the documents.
I think before the day was through, Ari Adler, who's a spokesman for the Snyder administration, remarked that the governor's office had turned over hundreds of thousands of pages, that's a quote, of records to Todd Flood. This is an important person in the Attorney General's office. Kyle, what's your take on this?
Well, he's the special person that Bill Schuette's hired to address this Flint water situation. And the governor's office said, well, if there's documents, you haven't told us yet. What documents are you talking about? So, what Bill Schuette had said was at a press gathering, and it was described as a roundtable where folks from the media would ask him questions on whatever subjects were on their mind. And obviously, this came up, and I think Schuette was prepared for it. But I think it talks of a kind of just this larger presence we're seeing from Bill Schuette, just not on the Flint water situation, but on other issues as well. You know, he just filed charges against the sitting state representative. He's been heavily involved in the Todd Corser, Cindy Gamrat affair, even though those charges haven't really come to pass as maybe would be expected. And on this Flint water situation, he's got criminal charges. He's looking at civil charges. He's getting into the governor's business. So this is part of, I think, a very omnipresent situation we're seeing from Bill Schuette.
Are you insinuating that his office is more active than it would otherwise be if he were not interested in being governor?
Well, I don't know about that. He's just very active right now. Just a lot to tackle here. This Flint water situation, I think he's just seeing a situation that could involve his help. And even though there's hundreds of civil suits, it looks like he's getting involved in one of his own.
Let's listen to a little bit of what the Attorney General had to say. At one point, Bill Schuette commented, this is in the group press conference. He met the press for, I don't know how long it was, but it was just a couple of days ago.
Nearly 40 minutes when you get down to it.
Nearly 40 minutes. At one point, referring to the documents he's not receiving from the Snyder administration, he said, quote, I think we'll solve that. But he also said the following.
We're trying to have discussions so we get all the documents we require. But if we don't get the documents that we require, then we'll solve the problem otherwise, other ways.
John Lindstrom, do you see a lawsuit as a possibility?
Certainly a possibility, but we shall see. I mean, as Ari has said, Ari Adler, that is, what are the documents you need? The governor's office has really tried to go overboard in many respects in getting stuff out. I mean, every one of us who are reporters have been flooded with hundreds of thousands of pages of emails that we've been going through, that we're still going through. We just had a major drop of emails last week. But to the point that Kyle has made, there's, you know, everyone knows that the Attorney General is running for governor, that he has every interest in running for governor. He's got billboards up around the state saying Bill Schuette doing a great job. You know, that's not something paid for by the Attorney General's office. So how much of his interest in that is driving what's going on here and what is not? I mean, one of the interesting questions that was raised during the press conference was, what did your attorneys in the environmental division, what conversations did they have with the DEQ people before it was discovered that there was lead and while that process was underway? Did anybody from Flint contact the Attorney General's office directly during that time frame from 2014 to mid-2015 mm-hmm. with complaints? And he said, I don't know. We'll find out and we'll get back to you. So there was a question raised as to, did the Attorney General's office also drop the ball somewhat on the Flint water situation? Mm.
Let's consider another development this month, also involving the AG's office. Civil charge, we alluded to this previously, civil charges were filed this month by his office against two private firms, engineering firms, involved in Flint water. Let's review the basics here. Who's charged with what, Kyle?
Yeah, so we've got Veolia and a company called LAN. The abbreviations are LAN. And these are companies that were involved in various parts and in various degrees with investigating and taking a look at Flint's transition from the Detroit water system to the Flint River water, and in varying degrees. Now, these companies have come out and, in one case, have set up their own web page to defend themselves, to say, hey, look, we did very little and had very little to do with what ended up happening.
That was LAN, by the way.
Right, yeah. And we're just doing what the officials in Flint and the state told us to do, and then we got out. It's interesting that Bill Schuette has decided to go after them in civil court because he's not the only one. There are literally hundreds of lawsuits that have been filed in Genesee Circuit Court targeting at least one of these engineering firms for the same type of civil liability that Bill Schuette's looking for. And so it kind of raises a question here that if Bill Schuette is running concurrent with these civil suits, and these civil suits are dealing with private citizens in the city of Flint who feel like they were damaged because of this lead-tainted water, how is that going to work in court? And what would happen if Bill Schuette was able to get money, but these private citizens are not? These are questions that haven't been answered yet, but are something that I think the press is going to be keeping a very keen eye on.
One of the two companies here, Veolia, was charged with fraud. Let's listen to a key figure in those charges, Noah Hall. Mr. Hall joined us on Current State here just last week. He's a special assistant attorney general working in the AG's office. Here he describes the fraud charge.
Veolia told the residents the water was safe. Veolia told the residents the cause of the brown water was merely old rusty pipes or a water main break. Veolia said there was no reason for further concern, no health concerns, no fundamental, never mentioned corrosion and what it could do in terms of lead.
John Lindstrom, what is the state seeking here?
Well, on the face of it, what they're seeking is hundreds of millions of dollars, which in theory could then, even though the Attorney General has basic control over that money. In theory, that could go towards helping mitigate the costs of the Flint situation. Beyond that, it's a little unclear. The Veolia and land folks have in effect, at least publicly, discussed a strategy, a defense strategy that almost sounds like they're going to seek immunity because they're saying the state, everyone knows that the state was really to blame for this situation. As Kyle has pointed out, there have been hundreds of suits filed privately against Veolia and land, and you begin to wonder, is this all going to be part of a total legal strategy where the company, where the state joins with the private lawsuits, where the company comes to some massive settlement agreement where the state gets so much, the private citizen gets so much? It's very hard to say. But in the end, what they're looking for, at least on face, is money, as well as the imprimatur of we are doing these things and we're not going to let anybody get away with it, whether it's state, private, or otherwise.
Have we heard from the attorneys who will be representing either LAN or Veolia in these civil suits?
Not so far, really, no.
We don't even know who's representing them, really.
No, I mean, one of the companies did put up a website in which they scoffed at the civil suit as just being ridiculous, but outside of that, we haven't heard a lot.
And that would be LAN. LAN, by the way, stands for Lockwood, Andrews, and Newnham. The website, if you'd care to take a look, LANFlintWaterLitigation.com. LANFlintWaterLitigation.com. Any thoughts on a timeline emerging here?
Oh, Lord, when you're dealing with a civil case, especially of this magnitude.
Forever.
Well, it could be forever. Then again, if you can reach, you know, a cooperative agreement with everyone, it could be pretty quick. But I would expect it to take some time.
Well, I mean, if you take a look at the situation back in the 70s, what was that, the PPP?
Or PBB.
PBB,
yeah. That took years, right? I mean, it started in the 70s, and I think the final suit on that didn't break up until 1983. So in that case, that took several years, and there's no reason to think this won't either. And in fact, this impacted more people, has the government involved, whereas the other one, the government was able to get out of by and large. This one, the government is heavily involved and arguably substantially liable, if not primarily liable. So this one, I would presume, is going to take a lot longer.
Kyle Malin of the MERS News Service, John Lindstrom of Gongwer News, Michigan. It's Current State's Month in Review here on WKAR. The AG's office was given approval this week to spend up to $4.9 million more on outside legal assistance to work on Flint investigations. How important is this?
Well, what the Attorney General will say, has said, this week, is justice isn't cheap, and that, you know, he's hired some very good, very expensive investigators to look into this. So they're going to cost a lot of money. The counter to that people have been saying is, wait a minute, you've got investigators who theoretically have looked into the mafia at various times. How come you aren't using your guys? Your guys seems to have handled pretty well in a number of other cases. Isn't this money that the state could save? Isn't this money that the state could use towards helping pay off Flint? So it's pretty simple. You've got some high-priced attorneys. And there's also the question that the Democrats raised from the very beginning about Todd Flood having made donations to not only the Attorney General but to Governor Snyder, and whether or not there was a question of, about would this actually be a fair investigation with these private investigators.
We'll wrap the Flint portion here of this month in review, which seems to be getting longer every month, but we'll wrap it on what seems to be a more positive note. It was announced a week ago today by the Federal Department of Health and Human Services that filtered Flint water is safe for everyone to drink. That includes pregnant women, nursing mothers, everybody. How was this news received by Flint residents? Do we know?
With skepticism. I mean, for months, you know, they were told that this water is not safe to drink, and now the filtered portion of it is safe. It's going to take some time, I think, for the residents to feel safe drinking their water. And I'm sure there's some residents who will never drink it again, who are just scared about what could possibly be in it. You're asking us to trust government when government is the entity that poisoned it in the first place. That's a real hard ask. And so I'm going to be, it's going to take some time, maybe a generation before people are going to be able to trust their drinking water again.
I'm not surprised to hear that. By the same token, we did see President Obama drinking Flint water. The governor apparently drank it for a month. If that's not I get it. I understand the skepticism, but even the president is on board, it would appear.
I wouldn't drink it. If I went to Flint right now, I wouldn't.
Yeah.
Oh, I would, just to see what it tastes like. But
You're adventurous, though, John.
And we have a colleague who, of course, has talked about how the Flint water is great. But, I think we all know who that is. But Kyle's absolutely right. In any circumstance, you're going to, people who have been burned and burned badly, it's going to take a long time.
It's a systemic failure.
Whether the president drank the water, the governor drank the water, the mayor comes to your house and drinks the water and goes to your tap and fills it up and drinks the water, people are still going to be very skeptical.
We saw the passage of a DPS bailout this month. Some people have a problem with that word, apparently, but it's still getting used. It's ostensibly what it is. This was a divisive and sometimes heated process. We've been over the basics often enough, I think, here. But a couple of weeks later, I want to ask both of you, what do you make of the public response to the DPS bailout, Kyle?
Well, I was pretty impressed, first of all, to think that a Republican legislature and a Republican governor were willing to dedicate state resources to the Detroit Public School District in roughly $700 million over 10 years. I mean, really, if you think about that, and you go back a year ago, and just the prospects of the Republicans giving Detroit schools that much money, it just seemed unfathomable. And yet it happens. So what I find interesting here is that the folks in Detroit, like the folks in Flint, have been burned by government. In this case, we had state government 15, 20 years ago take over their school district. They feel like have run it into the ground so badly. And now they feel like the state is just going to abandon them again with some old jalopy that's just going to sit there and rust out while charter schools and other folks who can make money off public education is going to get fat off the poor folks there in Detroit. So they are naturally skeptical of any solution that comes out of Lansing. Now, that said, what I think was interesting here is that how far the Republicans also came. They agreed that this Education Achievement Authority that the governor had set up some time ago has been a failure, and they have agreed to shut it down. They agreed that they are going to return control of a new school district to an elected school board, which will be elected in November and is not going to have to wait years as was originally proposed. So in that regard, I find it interesting that the Republicans have gone that far. That said, I think where the Detroiters would like to see things is kind of like a return back to what it was before Engler decided to take over the Detroit School Board. And since that is not necessarily on the table, they're going to make sure that Lansing owns this problem and owns it until they start seeing improvement in the fiscal situation and see some improvement in schools' test scores.
John, we got about a minute. Anything
Kyle's
more to
right
say?
Right, in many respects, the Republicans did move an enormous way since the governor first proposed his plan more than a year ago. That said, there were two salient factors that seemed to dominate the issue in the end. One was charter schools and how charter schools are going to be treated, and there was the educational commission that was going to oversee placement of schools and kept arguing that charter schools would not be ignored, charter schools would be part of it. The charter school supporters, absolutely furious with that, absolutely terrified that that would be the start of the state putting more overall control over charter schools. That was the line that could not be crossed. They would agree to anything else, but you couldn't put that in there. The second thing were the sick-outs by the Detroit teachers. And it is not coincidental that the sick-outs occurred and then the House bill moved. Because what they put into that was an effort to try to make sure that sick-outs cannot happen again, not just in Detroit, but basically anywhere. And so those two factors were the driving factors on this bill. That did help lead to a lot of what Kyle pointed out, were the agreements that were reached, but it's still, in terms of money alone, it is still not quite where the governor wanted it to be, not where the Detroit people wanted it to be, and it may not still be, in the end, be enough money.
We appreciate both of your insights. This has been Current States Month in Review for the month of June. We do it at the end of every month, the last weekday of the month. We want to thank John Lindstrom, publisher of Gongwer News Service, Michigan. Also thank you, Kyle Malin, editor and vice president of the Lansing-based MERS newsletter. Talk to you soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks, Mark.
Coming up on Current State, in Michigan, it's still legal to discriminate against someone based on sexual orientation or gender identity. There are two bills in the current session that would change that. One of them is sponsored by an upcoming guest here. State Senator Rebecca Warren joins us. We'll be talking with her to learn more about the bill and other issues in the Senate. That's on the way on Current State. Few American writers have enjoyed the loyalty of their readers as much as Laura Ingalls Wilder. Lapeer, Michigan author William Anderson has written extensively about the creator of the Little House on the Prairie stories. His most recent is titled The Selected Letters of Laura Ingalls Wilder. Earlier this year, Anderson told Current State Scott Pohl that he considered about 500 of the author's letters for the edition, choosing those that he felt were the most representative of her and her writing. Scott asked William Anderson what originally drew him to Wilder's books.
It's a long story, and it trails back to elementary school. I was one of the millions of school kids across America that were exposed to, indoctrinated in Wilder's series of books on pioneering. And I didn't know it at the time in third grade, but in elementary classrooms all over, teachers were reading those books and coordinating them with studies of Native Americans and pioneer frontier life. And I can remember my third grade teacher saying to us, as she took the book Little House on the Prairie off her shelf and began to read it, that you children will learn more about the pioneers from this book than our social studies book. And that went on to daily readings of those adventures of the Ingalls family as they made the long covered wagon trek to Kansas from Wisconsin and build up a new home. And all of those adventures that we read about in the books, we tried to duplicate in the classroom. We built a teepee. Of course, we churned butter and had cornbread and mapped out the journey and a big poster. So it was really a cross-literary and historical experience for us kids.
Was the Little House on the Prairie TV show a factor at that time? I'm not sure how old you are, how long ago you're talking about here.
We're talking about the late 60s when I heard the books. The television series was a product of the mid-70s to the mid-80s, and by that time, I was working as a summer tour guide at the Wilder home site, Ingalls Family Homestead in Desmet, South Dakota. What a great summer job that was. And the television series debuted about that time, and we quickly had to revamp our descriptions of the historic houses because we had TV visitors and the book reader visitors, and they were a completely different world. So the television show really did not follow the books very carefully.
I want to ask you what's in the stories of Laura Ingalls Wilder for the children of the 21st century.
Well, when Wilder first wrote those books in the 30s and 40s, she saw in her own life a huge transition from a family that traveled maybe 18, 20 miles max in a day by covered wagon to owning a car on her rural farm in Mansfield, Missouri. And she traveled swiftly by train. She made a plane flight. She had electricity, radio. Everything had changed so radically from her childhood. And that's one of the things that impelled her to write these books. She said that she wanted American children to know about the beginnings of things in this country. And she saw, you know, that way of life had just about vanished by her 60s when she started writing the books. And that was one of her reasons. The other reason for writing the books was economic. She had always been interested in writing and had a career as a country journalist. And her daughter, Rose Wilder Lane, was the real literary star in the family. She was a best-selling author in the 20s, 30s, 40s. And Laura wanted to try her hand at writing. And when the family's money was wiped out in the Depression, that seemed a good time for her to start writing books for children.
We're talking with William Anderson, author of The Selected Letters of Laura Ingalls Wilder and other books about Laura Ingalls Wilder. Tell me about these letters. Who did she write letters to?
When I wrote the initial biography of Laura Ingalls Wilder that I did a number of years ago, I accessed a lot of her letters as resource material. She didn't keep any diaries to speak of in her adult life. We know of her pioneer childhood. It's like an open book. But after she grew up and moved with her husband to Rocky Ridge Farm in Missouri, there isn't much in her own words to tell about that way of life except in the letters. And the bulk of her papers and correspondence are kept at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library in Iowa. And I studied those letters a lot in writing the biography and other assorted books that I've done. And I always had in the back of my mind that it would be good to put together a collection of her correspondence. And I had all these file folders labeled by year and the photocopies of the letters stuck in. So finally it came to fruition last year. HarperCollins, her publisher and my publisher, asked me if I would do this project, and it was fun putting it all together.
Well, who was she writing to, and what was she writing about?
Well, the first part of the book, she was writing about concerns of a farm wife. She wrote for the Missouri Ruralist, so she had an editor there that she corresponded with. She wrote to her friends, her family. And the heart of the book is, to me, the lengthy correspondence that she carried on with her daughter, Rose Wilder Lane, while the Little House books were being created. Because Laura and Rose had a collaborative teamwork in the making of those books. So we learn about her craft, and we learn about how those books were actually made. Finally, the book is full of her responses to her fans, and she got thousands of fan letters every year, lots, interestingly enough, from Michigan. So I included some of the letters she wrote to school children and librarians, teachers, and so on in Detroit, Saginaw, Mount Pleasant, even East Jordan, Michigan. So Michigan has a role in this book.
Here's something I'm curious about. How are these letters similar to the Little House books, and how are they different? Here's what I'm getting at. Being private correspondence, was she letting her hair down? You know, her readers know her primarily as a child and as a young woman. What was the older woman, Laura Ingalls Wilder, like? Do we see much of that in these letters?
I think we do, particularly in her correspondence with her daughter, Rose. We see her as a very tough-minded person. When they would debate on how the book should progress or what the theme of the book should be or characterization, they could pitch a pretty heated battle between them. And I think that Laura was a strong character. Her books hint at that. Remember when she married Almanzo Wilder, she refused to allow the word obey to be used in the wedding ceremony. So she was a woman that knew how to stand her ground, and in her correspondence with her agents and editors, she made it very plain that she expected to be paid top dollar for her work.
I want to ask you about a couple other areas of interest that you've written about. One is the Trapp family. What inspired your interest in the family from The Sound of Music?
Well, the Von Trapps run a lodge in Stowe, Vermont. Trapp Family Lodge, which was their home after they came here to America. And on one of our family vacations when I was a kid, we stopped there and visited. And that was after the movie Sound of Music had made such an imprint on American culture. And I read about the Von Trapps, got to know them because they still own and operate the lodge. And when I was a young journalist, they had a grand reopening of their new lodge after the previous one had burned. And I was sent up there by several magazines to cover that story. So I got to know the Trapps pretty well. And then my Japanese translator and publisher said to me one time, you know, Japan is so fascinated by this movie and by the Von Trapps, we really need a book about their real lives, and you seem to know them well. So I did the first version of the book, The World of the Trapp Family, for my Japanese publisher, and then it came out in Chinese, and then we did the American edition. So it was just a very serendipitous process that developed that book.
You also collaborated with Wally Bronner of the famous Bronner's Christmas Wonderland in Frankenmuth on his book.
I did, and that connects with the Von Trapps as well, because several members of the family came to Bronner's to do appearances, sign books, sign my book with me. And I remember saying to Wally just offhandedly, you know, Wally, people that come to Bronner's, they must look around at this tremendous place and wonder what was the origin of it. And he told me that story many times, how he started out as a sign painter. And then I heard from Wally later, and he said, Bill, will you help me write my autobiography? And that was a pleasure working with Wally, a great guy, and he is much missed today at Bronner's. But the book exists to tell the wonderful story of how that place was created.
William Anderson, thank you.
Thank you so much. Good to talk to you.
Coming up on Current State, Michigan school children are well into their summer vacation. Many are participating in supervised activities, but others are spending time in front of screens, sometimes unsupervised. You know where we're going. Current State's Brooke Allen talks with Michigan Secretary of State Ruth Johnson about the Protect My Child Registry. It's a way to protect kids from adult content on their electronic devices. That and more coming up on Current State. Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Last night was our latest pop-up stories event. Storytelling took place at Allen Marketplace in Lansing. We had a great lineup of storytellers sharing first-person true stories on the theme, Putting Down Roots. Tracy Ali is from Detroit, and she told the story of how she came to Lansing to visit her sister and ended up moving here.
The fourth day of my vacation down here in Lansing, I found a house. The fifth day I was down here, I found a job.
One eventful vacation there from Tracy Ali. It was a great evening of first-person stories last night. Our next pop-up stories event Thursday, July 28th at Valley Court Park, East Lansing. Our theme is The Call of the Wild. The Call of the Wild. We hope to see you there. More information at our Facebook page, Pop-Up Stories Lansing. The mass shooting in Orlando at a gay nightclub more than 2 weeks ago brought pain, anger, and sadness to Americans across the country. Here in Michigan, it's also re-sparking the debate over gay rights. In our state, it's still legal to discriminate against someone based on sexual orientation or gender identity. There are two bills in the current legislative session that would change that. One of them is sponsored by our next guest, State Senator Rebecca Warren. Ms. Warren is serving her second term as state senator for the 18th District, which covers much of Washtenaw County, including Ann Arbor, Ypsilanti, and Saline. She joins us by phone from Ann Arbor today. Senator Warren, welcome to Current State.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you on for the first time and hopefully not the last. What would this bill do that you've introduced?
What this bill would do is to update Michigan's Civil Rights Act, or Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act, to include sexual orientation, gender identity, and expression as protected classes in our civil rights statute. And so what this means is that right now in Michigan, you can still be fired from your job or denied housing because of who you are or who you love. And this protection in the Civil Rights Act would make that protection positive for all of our citizens.
Attempts have been made over the years to amend Elliott Larson in this direction. Has something changed?
I think there are some things that have changed. First and foremost, we've had the marriage equality decision, which really, I think, has brought the issue to the forefront. People are thinking more about, how ridiculous it is that we still deny certain rights to certain groups of people. And I think that our business communities here around the country, but here in Michigan, has gotten more organized and said, what they know from their day-to-day work is that the more diversity we have, the more that we support people and their families, no matter what those families look like, the better our economy, the better things work. And so you have a whole group of Michigan business leaders who are calling for the legislature to make this kind of a change. And we didn't always have that before.
Do you think the issue is getting more attention in light of the Orlando tragedy?
I think it is. And, we started to hear stories after the Orlando tragedy that, not everyone was out, had already had conversations with their families about their sexual orientation. They maybe had not had conversations with their employers about that. So if that had happened in Michigan, while some of those folks were still in the hospital recovering, they could be fired from their job. And I think that kind of having that conversation with folks that, absent this protection, people really could be losing their livelihood, be losing housing. And I think it's making people stop and think, like, could that really be real? Could it really be real that you can be fired for your job in Michigan? In fact, you can.
Summarize the response here that you've been hearing to Senate Bill 315. How are other legislators, how is the public responding to it?
I think in the general public, I get a lot of positive support. I think really people can't believe in 2016 that still could be possible, that there are no protections for people in this sort of group of folks. But in the legislature, it's been a slow process. We've been trying to work on this legislation for a number of years. I've been elected at the state level now for 10 years and have been working on this legislation for the entire 10. And it does take time, I think, to bring people along, unfortunately. But I use an example. One of the other bills that I worked on for a number of years was some protections for our smallest Michiganders and our nursing mothers. And it took 5 years to get that legislation passed, but we finally got it done and got it passed unanimously through the Senate. So I'm going to keep working and going to keep talking to folks and trying to make progress. But it does seem to take a little longer to get the legislature to come along with what the general public already accepts as just common sense legislation.
We'll point out to our listeners that there is a similar bill, a bill similar to yours in the House, House Bill 4538, sponsored by Joan Hoadley. Are there significant differences between these two?
No, not at all. They're very, very similar legislation, yeah. And we did, at the end of last session, we did have the chance to at least have a committee hearing on this legislation in the House. And there are still questions that people have about how to implement it in a way that respects people's religious, rights. Like so we had worked with the drafters and worked with folks in the community to say nothing in this legislation requires someone to say if their faith is not supportive, like to marry people in their house of worship if this is not what they want. Before the marriage equality decision, I think now that we have a marriage equality decision, people are really kind of gone back to the drawing board to say, hey, maybe we actually could move forward on this. So I do get more positive feedback even in the legislature now.
I am speaking with State Senator Rebecca Warren, the Democrat who represents the 18th Michigan Senate District here, much of Washtenaw County. We're talking about legislation she's proposed to prevent people from being discriminated against for sexual orientation or gender identity. I want to make clear to our listeners, and I want to let you know, you might be interested to know if you don't know already, that yesterday on this program, a gay Lansing man who was the victim of an attack that the courts determined was because he was gay. This is Todd Haywood we're talking about. You may be acquainted with Todd. He's been in the legislature and covers the legislature as a reporter. He believes his case may play a part in hate crimes legislation here in Michigan, and he told our listeners that he expects the legislature to announce a measure toughening hate crimes beginning in July. I have to assume you would be supportive of a measure along those lines.
Absolutely. I think that, our hate crimes legislation, again, also really just is not very strong in protecting, if something's racially motivated or motivated by someone's faith, we have protections for our LGBTQ citizens. We just don't have that same protection. And I think, like I said, I think a lot of folks now are saying this is just a common sense addition to both our hate crime statute and our Civil Rights Act.
Michigan is, we'll point out, Michigan is one of 18 states that does not include sexual orientation in its hate crimes law. Let's shift gears here a little bit. You've also introduced legislation to end the tampon tax. This is another topic recently discussed on our show with a nonprofit called Helping Women, Period, was here. Your bills, 898 and 897, what would they do?
Exempt feminine hygiene products from our state sales tax or use tax, depending on how they're purchased. And this really came about for me. I've had the chance to serve on my chamber's tax policy committee the entire time I've been in the legislature. So in tax policy in the House and now Senate Finance Committee, which is our version of the tax policy committee. And, you know, under Michigan law, there aren't very many things that we exempt from sales tax. We exempt medicine. We exempt food, but most of the time we charge a sales tax when you purchase things. And we've done some in the last legislative session, we started looking at exempting things like data centers from sales tax. And it really just motivated me to say, where do we have inequities in our tax code? And right now, prescription drugs, eyeglasses, canes, all these things that are medically necessary are exempt from sales tax, but an expense that women have for, a large percentage of their life, month after month after month, they pay a sales tax on. So if eyeglasses and prescription drugs and catheters aren't subject to a sales tax, it just seems fair to me that our feminine hygiene products shouldn't be subject to a sales tax either.
How confident are you of movement on those? Are you more confident or more unconfident?
I actually, even when the bill was being introduced, I had some of my Republican colleagues say, we pay a sales tax on that right now? Like, I think it's one of those things that people were, again, unaware of the inequity, and it just makes sense. I think it's hard to argue with if something is, medically necessary and we don't tax all these other things, why would we put a tax on that? It's kind of exciting, too, because we see around the region and around the country, places like the city of Chicago, the state of New York, Maryland, a lot of places are starting to look at this issue, see it as a gender fairness issue, and have already done away with sales tax on all these products. And a number of states, about seven more besides Michigan, have pending legislation right now, too. So it's moving. And the whole country of Canada, they made the decision in 2015 to get rid of tax on these products. So there's definitely momentum building.
Democratic State Senator Rebecca Warren, representing the Michigan 18th District, covering Ann Arbor, Ypsilanti, and Saline, and much of Washtenaw County. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, we're officially into summer, and while plenty of kids will be spending time participating in supervised activities, others will be spending time in front of screens, sometimes unsupervised. Michigan Secretary of State Ruth Johnson says there's a way to protect kids from adult content on their electronic devices. It is the Protect My Child Registry, which became available to Michiganders 14 years ago. WKAR's Brooke Allen speaks with Ruth Johnson about the registry and its purpose.
This is kind of like a national do not call list. So once we get the information, we let those types of advertisers know it's private and it's secure. And then there's penalties, like senders or advertisers who violate the law face stiff criminal penalties and civil penalties, too, up to 3 years in jail and criminal fines of up to $30,000 and maybe civil penalties of $5,000 per message. So it's important. It's similar to a do not call list. It does not take care of everything. It takes care of advertisers.
Okay, so if an advertiser does contact a child who's on this list and a parent finds out about it, is there a way to file a complaint?
Yes, the Michigan Attorney General's Office is responsible for the enforcement against violators of the Michigan Children's Protection Registry Act. We take this very seriously. We don't need our kids getting into this kind of information by people that advertise. It's just not great. It's just not a good thing for the kids at all. And we need to put in place social media safeguards for today's most popular apps for these types of advertisers. Kids are so savvy, and most teens say they know how to hide what they do online from their parents. So it's a way for parents to get ahead of the curve. ProtectMyChild.com, Michigan's ProtectMiChild.com, and they can learn more. And on there is also tips on how to keep your kids safe when they're playing games online, and how to set up safety features on your devices, and how to put in place social media safeguards.
Have there been any studies done as far as what you have been able to tell as far as what age? I mean, if I have four-year-old twins, and they do have iPads, but they only have apps as far as games. So, I mean, they're not hooked up to the internet at all.
That's a good thing, in my opinion, by the way. I don't think you can start too soon, because things change every day in the world of technology. And if it's not happening for a two-year-old that's online right now, it may. And I know I signed up my mom. She's 78 years old at the time. She's 89 now, but I got her a computer and set it all up, and all of a sudden she started getting these ads that were very inappropriate. So I think it's important to go on protectmychild.com to learn more, and you can find out already about half our public school districts are on to stop that kind of content coming to school computers. It's never too early to get that kind of protection.
Also on the website, there are tips to help other issues as well.
There is. There's tips for digital parenting. And I know I have a 16-year-old. I simply cannot keep up. And matter of fact, I hand her my phone sometimes and say, will you fix this? So that's why it's so important. It's a world that changes so quickly of how people communicate and how they use electronic devices.
Exactly. And as we both know, not always for good, right?
Yes, it does bring the world into your living room. It's a wonderful thing, but it's a double-edged sword, and this is one way to protect from the bad parts of technology, because I just think it's wonderful that I can go online and look up just about anything anyone can look up. We don't have encyclopedias anymore, right? And so everything's up to date online. That's what's great about it.
I know. It is crazy, though. I was thinking about that driving in, thinking I was going to talk to you, and I thought, you know, it's insane, because years ago when I was graduating, I mean, we had no idea it was going to be like this.
Oh, my gosh, no. My mom still has encyclopedias from 1961 in her house.
Those might be worth something.
Yeah, they might be. But I think about all the work it took to look up something, and now in 5 minutes, you have the whole world at your fingertips. If you want to know anything about nature or science or other cultures or other types of money, how to travel, how to do things cheaply and effectively at home with natural ingredients, you name it, it's on there. But there is threats that go along with this, and that us as adults have to protect our kids from.
Exactly, and thank you so much. I really appreciate your time this morning.
You too.
For Current State, I'm Brooke Allen.
And that's our show for today. Tune in tomorrow for an encore edition of Current State. Then on Monday, join us for a special 4th of July broadcast, Independence Day, a history of July 4th. You might not know that the 4th of July didn't even become a paid day off in America until 1938. It's an outrage. 1938, before the 4th of July was a paid day off in our country. That and other great information, interesting hour here on Independence Day, a history of July 4th. That is Monday in lieu of Current State. We'll be back on Tuesday after we've had our fill of food and fireworks. We hope you have a safe holiday. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Katie Cook directed our program today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Jamie Paisley, Kevin Lavery, Brooke Allen, and Drew Hill. The Current State podcast is always there. You can listen to this program anytime in just a variety of circumstances, informative, insightful, and indispensable. It's anywhere, anytime on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also stay connected with Current State on Twitter and on Facebook, of course. Find us on Twitter at KAR Current State or on Facebook at Current State from WKAR. Thanks again for the great turnout last night at our Pop-Up Stories event at the Allen Marketplace. Once again, we're back at it with true first-person storytelling on Wednesday, July 28th at Valley Court Park in East Lansing. We hope you can join us then. It's Current State on WKAR.